content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. Sweet Justice by Melissa Mead. May I help you? Said the store owner to the old woman.
Do you sell industrial-strength candy, young man?
We certainly do. Hans came out from behind the counter, beaming. We also carry 5 grades of structural gingerbread, from light gold to dark and spicy, if you'll follow me. He led the woman into the warehouse, pointing out load-bearing lollipops, candy cane trusses, and sugar shingles. This is our do-it-yourself section. If you're building from the ground up, you can get flour in 50-pound bags, sugar in 25, and brown sugar by the brick, dark or light. His customer sniffed.
Adequate, but I've got the basic house already. I'm looking for something to pretty it up for when the kiddies come over for dinner. Decorative bits.
Frosting? We carry royal icing by the gallon. We're also running a special on fondant siding, a half price on installation.
That's a start.
We do piped-on trim, wafer cookie shutters.
Keep going.
Also landscaping, crushed rock candy paths, lemonade fountains, lollipop trees, stick candy fencing. Let me show you our catalog. While she read, Hans tried to avoid looking out the window or at the telephone. His fingers itched. The old woman turned the pages with agonizing slowness, muttering and sucking on her teeth. Finally, though, she closed the book and glared at Hans.
Mighty expensive. 20 silver for sugar windows?
You could try Big Bad Wolf's dens and dining rooms, but he's mostly about furniture.
Fine. I'll take 5 gallons of green icing, 6 of purple, a truckload of peppermints.
Hans took down her order and her name and address. Thank you, ma'am. We'll send someone right over. Once she left, he took a deep breath, counted to 10, and picked up the phone. Sis, it's Hansel. Tell your sergeant to send a squad over to Hungry Hollow pronto. We've got another one. Yeah, just like ours. I don't know, must be some kind of syndrome or something. But you've got to admit, better to catch 'em before they open that oven door.
I'm Mike Rumble. This is The Man and the River by Therese Pazinski. Once upon a time, in a far kingdom, there lived a man who fell in love with a river, and so he married it. One day, as he sat happily in the river, he glimpsed something. It moved swiftly beneath the surface, dark and strong. As it swam by, he grabbed it by the tail, and it pulled him pleasantly through the water. The landscape was beautiful, the water refreshing, the day warm, but eventually he grew tired. My friend, he said, please take me to shore. Without warning, the creature turned and bit the man's hand off. When the man screamed, it slapped his body with its great tail until blood dripped from the man's groin. Then it took the man to shore. 3 men had built a fire near the shore and sat around its light, talking quietly. The man scrambled onto land. He ran to them and showed them how he'd been maimed. One of the men, who was very wise, shrugged his shoulders and said, "You have met the alligator. It is of the river." "Alligator? I did not marry an alligator. I married the river." "But the alligator is of the river, and so, in a way, when you married the river, you also married the alligator." The next day, as the man sat quietly in the river, the alligator swam to him and offered its tail. Warily, he took hold of it in his one hand, and when he grew tired of swimming in the river, he said nothing. Eventually, long after dark, the alligator took him safely to shore. The man felt deeply disturbed as he sat on the river bank. Every time he entered the river and the alligator offered its tail, He would not know whether it would return him safely to shore or whether it would maim him. He told himself that he would never again enter the water. That night he looked out over his love. The full moon reflected on her surface, silvery and bright. The water was beautiful, smooth, and polished as a mirror. The crickets started their music. Tears came to his eyes. It was hard to love the river, but fear the alligator. Later in his dreams, the river came to him in her woman's form. She had dressed in a gown of water and the stars, and her dark hair billowed behind her like the cusp of night. She held out her arms and beckoned to him. Her voice sounded like a brook moving over small stones. "Come back to me." He awoke and knew that he must decide. Did he leave his true love because of his fear, or did he accept the fear and return to the river? And then he realized that she still stood before him in her woman's form. He reached for her with his one hand. The man returned to the river, though forever after he was more wary of the things that came up from her current's depths.
My name is Mark Lee, and I'll be reading White as Snow, Red as Blood by Melissa Mead. Snow woke in a glass coffin with the taste of bitter apple in her mouth and a stranger's face staring into hers, a face with alarming pointed teeth. She sat up, pressed her hand to her stinging neck, and stared at the two dots of blood on her palm. The stranger broke into a smile, making those teeth all the more prominent. "Ah, good. It hasn't been too long. How do you feel?" "All right." Snow looked around. The moonlight seemed as bright as day. All seven of her friends watched from behind a gnarled pine tree, their faces ashen with terror. "What's wrong?" she asked him. "Really, I'm all right." "Actually, I'm afraid you're not," said the stranger, offering her a hand out of the coffin. He didn't look too well himself. Alarmingly pale, bluish around the lips, but he moved with strength and grace and wore a gold coronet as though he was accustomed to it. "Technically, you're dead. If you come with me, I'll explain." Snow's heart plummeted, but she forced a smile. "At least my stepmother will leave me alone." Alas, she was wrong. Back at her castle, Snow's stepmother gloated over her triumph. She combed her hair smooth, bathed her face in milk, and dressed in her finest silk and jewels before sitting at her mirror and demanding that it name the fairest woman in the land. Had she said the fairest living woman, she might have gotten a different answer. As it was, the mirror replied, "Snow White." How the queen raged. She cursed, she flung blush pots, and at last she shattered the mirror, ignoring the wail of the anguish that rose from the shards. The queen reached the palace at midnight. The surrounding forest lay in shadows, but the castle windows glowed with candlelight. She stormed through the great doors without knocking and found herself in dimly lit hall. Snow stood before her, her pale face troubled. "I wish you hadn't come, stepmother." "You impertinent hussy. How dare you speak to me that way? Leave quickly. My husband and I agreed to give you this one chance. Go home, stop this ridiculous rivalry, and we'll let you be. Husband, you old trollop. With you lying in a coffin all this time, I'd like to see that." "As you wish." A young man in an old-fashioned suit and a gold coronet entered the room and placed a gentle hand on Snow's arm. "Stepmother, may I present my husband?" The young man inclined his head. "So you admitted that you left my wife lying in a coffin. She was dead." "This time, she was dead. I know it." "So she is, and you made sure of it," he agreed, smiling. His smile showed his alarmingly pointed teeth, and yet Snow White is still the fairest of them all. He took the stepmother by one arm, and Snow took the other, their grips inhumanly strong. "Please come in. You're just in time for our wedding supper."
My name is Evelyn Evans. This story is titled Foundering Fathers by Brian K. Lowe. Soames, you haven't by any chance solved those fourth dimensional differential equations of yours, have you? My valet's face remained impassive, but I had learned by now to read his eyes, which most would term steady, with perhaps a touch of stern, and they told me a sad tale of continuing futility. Not at this juncture, sir. And when, pray tell, might this juncture be located? Tasting the bitter fruit of experience had taught me that upon our present course, when was far more critical than where. The moment when we returned to the 26th century, I was going to seize one Cyril Bassington Santiago by the scruff of the neck and, public school chum or not, pitch him bodily into this infernal used time machine of his and set it on a one-way course to the late Pleistocene, which, knowing the fickle nature of the mechanism, it would never see. According to the chronograph, sir, Soames made a show of consulting the device. I took this as an uncharacteristic sign of his unease. Soames does not typically make a show of anything he does. We have emerged in the latter half of the 18th century. I shall know more precisely presently, sir. I despaired that his use of the word presently was a subtle attempt at humor, since for all of Soames' sterling qualities, jollity is absent from their midst. It would be funny in a gallows sense, since our present was also our past. Although, to be scrupulously correct, our future was also our past, right up until our present. I was thinking rather of the time of day, Soames. I find this undisciplined ratcheting back and forth in time parches the old Webster throat. In truth, though, I feared even Soames' ability to find the makings of a decent scotch and soda prior to 1900. Perhaps you should take the opportunity for a small perambulation, sir. Exercise does stimulate the brain. I thought it would be more productive for him to indulge in some mind-stimulating exercise while I remain behind in the relative comfort of the chronosphere, nursing a soothing beverage. Nevertheless, if my sacrifice could in any way grease the gears of Soames' marvelous thought processes, I was prepared to perform my duty for the greater good. I let myself out. We were ensconced in a shady lane off a dirt road. The sun was high, the sky was clear. Spying the outskirts of town, I strode forth to see the sights. It took some little time to reach the city center. The streets were crowded. Women carried shopping baskets on their arms, while dark-skinned servants in colorful scarves held parasols over their heads. Men in long coats and powdered wigs looked as uncomfortable as they did fashionable. My chameleon suit not only mimicked the local styles, it protected me from temperature and humidity. It did nothing, however, to protect my sense of smell, which was assaulted on every side. How fortunate that Soames had dispatched me to be my own Mercury on this errand, for among such a fragrance of humanity, I doubt he would have been able to do less than proclaim the establishment of a public bath directly here in the street. Such a declamation would doubtless constitute what my nanny would have protested as a really bad idea. Like the crowd, then, it seemed that the time to explore one of the nearby business establishments was ripe. No sooner did I direct my sight down the street than I espied a sign with a foaming tankard, and there I set my steps. There were only two patrons in the taproom, conversing quietly. I sat at a rough table and gestured to the nearest servant. "A glass of your finest ale, my lady." The Webster men run more toward the genteel and cultivated than the classically handsome, but we have always made up for that with our scandalously fulsome bank accounts. I placed a local coin, supplied by Soames, via the ship's computers, on the table. "And that's yours if I can count on your individual attention." Her eyes widened as she saw the coin. "You can have as much of my ale as you like, sir," she said loudly. "But we runs a respectable establishment here." She snapped up the coin and dropped it into her capacious bosom. dropping her voice to a stage whisper. "Me name's Annie." After a word with the barkeep, she headed for the stairs. I looked at her, then the barkeep, and finally at my empty table. "Well, sir, you paid for it. Aren't you going to use it?" One of the pair had turned to examine me. His friend wore an amused expression. When I frowned, the speaker pointed towards the upstairs where my waitress had disappeared. "Is that the private salon?" I asked. He laughed. "You could say that, sir. It's very private." Now, no one had ever accused the Websters of being megalocephalic, for which I had Soames, but neither are we bringing up the rear of the mob of human evolution. A light burst in my head. "Oh, heavens, I just wanted a beer. It's so hot." "Then you have overpaid handsomely, but Mr. Dawes and I would be honored to help consume your credit." He gestured at the barkeep. "Paul Revere, sir, at your service. And my colleague is Mr. William Dawes." I moved to their table, shaking hands vigorously. Hardly in town and already making friends. "Barclay Webster, so honored to make your acquaintance." Three tankards arrived. Mr. Revere made short work of his and ordered three more. When I offered to stake my new friends another round, he assured me that I had already done so. So I toasted their health, and they mine, and then the health of their friend George, and then a different George. And all the while, I blessed the 26th century medicines that would keep my blood alcohol level to no more than a pleasantly fuzzy level. "To Thomas Paine," Dawes roared, lifting his glass. "To Thomas Paine," we echoed, and we drank. "Barclay," Revere said, "I want to let you in on a little secret. Can you keep a secret?" I nodded slowly. "No Webster has ever betrayed a secret." Revere nodded too, and I thought his head would fall right off. "Good, because young William and I, and some comrades, are working on a bit of mischief that King Georgie would not like too much. A group of us thinks the colonies should secede and break away from Great Britain. What do you think?" "Are you talking about a rebellion? People could get hurt." Dawes hiccuped. "Good heavens, Paul, he's right. Did we even think about that?" Revere snored. "Oh, he's in for the night then," Dawes declared. And his own head promptly dropped to the table. But a hand from above caught him, lowering his face gently to the wood. "Soames!" "Good evening, sir. Will you be returning for supper or dining out?" "To be honest, Soames, my friends and I had not even contemplated supper. What time is it?" "Well, it's dusk, sir. And if it's not too much of an imposition, I was rather hoping you might be dining out tonight." I frowned, making the world fold in odd corners until I stopped. This ancient brew was quite heady. "Really, Soames? Is there some reason you wouldn't want me coming home? Have you a lady friend?" He nearly blinked. "Oh, no, sir. I was researching this time period." I stole a look at my two companions, but they were dead to the world. And it appears we have arrived at a very propitious moment. This is April 18th, 1775. On this very night, Paul Revere and his comrade, William Dawes, will undertake to warn their fellows of the encroachment of British troops, an event chronicled in a famous poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, long a particular favorite of mine. The opportunity to see the ride itself would be of great interest. All of the alcohol in my head immediately fled south, leaving me sober as a priest on Sunday. "Paul Revere, you say?" He did not register my apprehension. "Yes, sir. Not only is it the inspiration for a very fine poem, but it is a pivotal moment in the 18th century history. Fascinating on many levels, sir." "I say, Soames, allow me to introduce you to my two friends." I indicated the duo snoring on the table. This is Mr. William Dawes and Mr. Paul Revere. Soames' lips actually twitched. Oh, dear sir, they must be awakened immediately. If they do not rouse the countryside, the colonist leaders, Samuel Adams and John Hancock, will be arrested by the British and summarily hanged. Hanged? Executed, sir. Executed? How barbaric! Indeed, sir, Earth's cultures were uniformly disposed towards barbarity in this period. In fact, matters did not markedly improve until the abolition of television in 2077. He turned to Dawes, slapping him lightly on each cheek. I followed his lead with Revere, but as Dawes had warned, there was no moving him. I appealed to Soames for one of his magic hangover elixirs. I fear, sir, that it only works on a gentleman after he has enjoyed several hours of sleep, and to force something down his throat now could choke him. By now Dawes was staggering around the room under his own power. What's going on? Who's he? Soames stood. I am a courier, sir, with reports of the British on the march. They are moving on Lexington. Dawes sobered on the instant. Lexington? They're coming for Adams and Hancock. This is what we've been waiting for. Come on, Paul, we... Oh, he looked at Revere, a sodden, snoring lump. I'll go myself. They must be warned. I'll go with you, someone cried. And with the utmost horror, I realized that someone had been me. Soames regarded me with a new light in his eyes. But whether it betokened a new respect or resolve to monitor my drinking more closely, I could not say. Dawes grabbed my arm to lead me outside. I sent Soames a silent plea for assistance. You proceed, sir, and I will attempt to rouse Mr. Revere. We may yet salvage the situation. Well, yes, that was easy to say when you were not running from armed troops, but such as my implicit faith in Soames that I had let it go. I had ridden a horse once, so I was at least peripherally aware of the mechanics. My lack of grasp of the finer points was instantly apparent to my mount. The night air being cool, I had wrapped a scarf around my neck, and, such as my horse's unbridled ruthlessness, that the scarf was blown into my face before I reached the next town. People scattered before me, and I tried to shout my message, so boisterous was my conveyance that I could not remove a hand from the reins for a moment. The I sputtered, but I despaired of any man comprehending a word of it. And then the scarf flew up into my eyes, and I could not even see. What did he say? I couldn't hear. Who was that masked man? I don't know, but I recognize the horse. It belongs to Paul Revere. Paul Revere? That must mean the British are coming. Others took up the cry, but I was borne away. The horse pounded through the countryside, carrying me like a sack of grain it would rather not be hauling. Somehow I avoided being dashed into a low branch. Whenever I heard voices, I repeated my cry, but whether my words were heard or lost in my scarf, which resisted my repeated efforts to dislodge, I could not be certain. Suddenly, we were slowing down. I managed to pull the scarf away, and there was William Dawes next to me, holding my horse's bridle. "It's done," he cried. "You have roused the entire countryside. Now you must ride to Mr. Adams and Mr. Hancock to warn them." I opened my mouth to reply that I didn't know Mr. Adams and Mr. Hancock from the President of Earth, but my words froze in my throat, and I could only stare. Dawes spun about to see for himself the cause of my consternation. "You will oblige us, sirs, by dismounting," said the man in the red suit and jolly hat. His odd costume was rendered far less ridiculous by the dozen others in similar attire who wielded what appeared to be quite nasty armaments, whose air of martial antagonism was only accentuated by the long pointed metal spikes that each sported at its end. The end, I might add, that was pointed towards us. We did precisely as we were bid. No sooner were we rudely ushered into place, however, when there came another disturbance. What is the meaning of this? Who is in charge here? And striding out of the darkness, into the knot of soldiers, decked out in the most outlandish red uniform with epaulets, white belt, buckled sword, and topped with a white wig, was my own man, Soames. Dawes started to speak, but I shushed him. "I'm in charge, sir. Sergeant LeBrand, sir." "Well, Sergeant," thundered Soames, "I am Major Soames, and in the event you did not receive the order, the Colonials are resorting to their old tricks and are headed south. All available units are to report to Colonel Webster immediately for new orders." "Colonel Webster, sir?" "I don't know him, sir." Soames somehow loomed even taller. "Don't know him? Well, he certainly will know you, Sergeant, if you don't turn around and do a double-quick march back to Boston." "But my prisoners, sir, will be taken into my custody. Now move, you impudent lout, unless you want to join them." In the blink of an eye, the troops retreated, leaving me grinning like a loon, and Mr. Dawes asking himself where he'd seen Major Soames before. When Paul Revere, miraculously steady on his feet, appeared at Soames' side, my poor friend William was completely out of his orbit. Revere and his horse were soon reunited, and with Dawes, off to warn the Colonials' leaders. Soames led me to our chronosphere. "How did you get Revere into the chronosphere, and what did you tell him it was?" Soames permitted himself a ghost of a smile, although in the dark I might have been mistaken. "Given Mr. Revere's state, sir, it was a simple matter to persuade him that anything he thought he saw was a product of his own imagination." "And how did you find us? Without you, the British might have..." I thought about his earlier use of the term hanged and fingered my collar. "That was entirely due to your own efforts, sir. You had so thoroughly alarmed the countryside that charting your course was simplicity itself." "I was impressed, if I might be so bold, sir, at your ingenuity in preserving your own identity and promoting the concept that it was, in fact, Mr. Revere who was riding through the entire time." I lifted my chin and shot my cuffs nonchalantly. "In times of urgency, one rises to the occasion, Soames. Websters are known for their composure under pressure." "Of course, sir. May I prepare you a nightcap? Your bed has been turned down." "Thank you, Soames. I must say, for all the congeniality of the local population, their taste in beer leaves much to be desired. It is a barbaric age, sir."
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.